you've got a transition from extreme stress, it slowly morphing into a more serious condition, which is burnout.
Hello and welcome to A Doctor's View, a podcast looking at everyday health topics and life through a doctor's eyes. Please note that all opinions are my own and should not replace the advice given to you by your own doctor. I'm Dr. Bolivios. Let's begin. Hello everyone and welcome to A Doctor's View. This episode is a follow-on episode from a previous podcast on burnout called The Devastating Effects of Burnout, A Real Life Story, published on 7th of August this year. I'll recap the story for those who have not yet heard it. In November 2018, the medical world lost a bright star, a kind and compassionate cardiologist who excelled in his work and he was loved by both patients and colleagues alike. Sadly, it was a consequence of work-related burnout. He tragically took his own life. In the podcast I published in August, I interviewed his brother, Amandip Sidhu. Amandip shared his story with the show and he spoke not only of the events which led to his brother's death, but also how both he and his family are taking superhuman efforts to spread the message and help those finding themselves in similar situation to his brother to ensure that this tragedy doesn't happen again. This is a story that we've sadly heard too many times, and work-related pressures are on the rise, especially in vocations like medicine. And so sadly, it still remains topical. I'm privileged to be working as a doctor, but it also means I see a lot of cases of stress amongst colleagues just very often, and not just amongst doctors, but in other sectors of the hospital and primary care as well. Since that episode was published, the feedback was quite extraordinary. It ranged from simple compliments of the show to people telling me how a simple courtesy listen turned into just captivation of Amandip's story. And it was quite rightly the most popular episode I had for many weeks in what was a relatively new podcast. And during that week, the show went from virtually unranked to number 11 in the iTunes medical podcast category. And it just shows how many people can relate to such events and just how many more want to learn about burnout in the workplace. It was obvious that a follow-up had to be done. With that, it's a great privilege to be once again joined by Amandip, who is now an advocate for personal well-being and has set up a charity called Doctors in Distress to not only help doctors suffering from burnout, but to help educate employers into how to avoid such tragedies from happening again in the future. I'm also joined by Dr. Sonia Hutton-Taylor, who's one of the foremost experts in burnout. Sonia has worked at the interface between career and performance and health and well-being for 30 years, and after an initial career in eye surgery, she set up the first independent career support service for doctors in 1990. She has assisted some of the most burnt-out people on the planet move through burnout effectively and either resume or change their careers. In 2017, she set up Burnout Geese for All Industries, a platform for sharing her unique perspective on burnout, causes and prevention, as well as offering thought-provoking innovation on burnout resolution. I'm very grateful to have them both on the show. Amandip, Sonia, welcome.
Thank you.
Thank you, Paul.
So we've recapped the story, and what I'd like to do this time is just begin with you, Sonia. If we could define burnout and some of the common myths and misconceptions that people have with it, because it's obviously a very important topic and we want people to know the exact definition and what they should be looking out for.
Yes, I'd love to do that. I think if I start with the World Health Organization, because earlier this year they came up with a definition of burnout, or a classification rather of burnout, where they say that it's a syndrome and it's only in an occupational setting and that it's chronic stress that has not been successfully managed. So that is the official definition. They also state that it's not a medical condition, which is interesting because it's the International Classification of Diseases that they've put it into. And I don't see quite how you can classify something as a disease and then say it's not medical. So I have a slight issue with several parts of the definition and with the World Health Organization's view that it's only people in a working situation. Because I've had clients who are carers, students, athletes, and their symptoms are identical. absolutely identical. So that's where I have a little bit of an issue with the WHO.
And how do they classify that group of people that have the similar symptoms but is not in a work-related environment? What do they call that?
Well, it could fall under any number of psychiatric, physical. It's actually extremely confusing because I don't know if you've ever looked at the ICD, but it's an enormous flowchart with multiple different strings to it. So it's navigating one's way around that is extremely difficult.
Okay. Sorry, Sonia, just a quick question, just if I may. So obviously being the non-medic here, obviously with the WHO coming out with the definition, I'm assuming that there may be some criteria by which people can diagnose against burnout. Is that a correct assumption or not?
I think it's probably early stages. My understanding of the WHO position is that they're doing further research on ways in which to try and diagnose and classify it even more accurately. Mm-hmm. But at the moment, I think it's quite sketchy, to be honest.
But I'm sure you'd agree that as a first step, at least there is some kind of definition or recognition of it as a phenomenon.
Yes, I think that's absolutely correct. And because prior to April and May this year, it wasn't really on the radar. But there's quite a lot of different ways of looking at burnout. So the simplest way that I look at it is it's like an empty cup. The cup has been drained of all the energy and effort that a person can put into something, but there's no replenishment, there's no restoration by, you know, stuff being poured into the top of the cup. So it's a cup with holes in it, really. That's the sort of simplest visual that I can come up with. And people sometimes say, oh, you know, it's a mental illness. And I've got a bit of an issue with that as well, because I don't think it's at all clear. In some ways, burnout has lots of physiological, physical manifestations, which would make one think, well, it's actually not a mental illness, it's a physical illness. But on the other hand, there is a very strong interface between burnout and some forms of mental ill health. For example, with Freudenberger's 12 stages of burnout, I think it's number 11 that is depression. And in theory, if you talk to somebody, you could see that they'd gone through all 12 different stages of it before they get to the absolute collapse at the end, which is number 12. But I think depression could come on at an earlier stage. The stage 11 is really quite advanced. And that might be where your brother got to.
So thank you for the definition, and I appreciate there's a little bit of confusion in terms of the overall. It's almost seems like an umbrella term that's been pinpointed just for work.
Yes, and there's a lot of misinformation on the internet. There's a lot of places that will say burnout is now recognised as a medical condition, whereas on the WHO website, it's very clear that it states it is not a medical condition. Now, they may change their stance on that at some point. That may not stay like that.
Well, I guess that's implying that there's no medical treatment for it then, in theory. If you haven't got a medical condition that you're treating, then there's no tablets that can help, there's no therapies that can help. And so it's quite contradictory in a way.
Absolutely. To give you an example, if you have diabetes and you don't know you've got it, but you go into a GP surgery anywhere in the UK, you will get an identical care pathway, pretty much identical.
Yes.
You will see the diabetic nurse, you will see the chiropodist, you'll have your sugars monitored, you will see the nutritionist, and there is a well-defined pathway for it. With burnout, I feel currently the state of play is there is nothing. Now, you couldn't take any individual GP and say that they have no plan at all for it, but there is no recognised, formalised, monitored care pathway for burnout.
Thank you. And in terms of some of the myths and misconceptions that people have regarding burnout, or even in themselves that feel that they may have it, and in recognising it in others, what do you feel have been the most common in your experience?
Well, one of the things that keeps coming up is people say, oh, well, it's just a bit of stress, isn't it? Stress is a precursor to burnout. So stress and burnout are very closely related, but they are not the same thing. And they are two completely different physiological states. And it can be measured by cortisol levels. So a very stressed person in general, and even this is subject to variation, but in general, somebody with severe stress would be measured as having high cortisol levels, whereas someone with extremist burnout is likely to have low cortisol levels. But there are confounding factors that would even make that not a diagnostic test. But it just goes to show that the two states are completely different.
That's very interesting. So as well as a slight physiological element to it, it seems to be mainly it is a psychological issue. Is that fair to say? Or
well, I think
not?
It's terribly complicated, because the reason the cortisol level drops and is high in stress and low in burnout is because the hypothalamic pituitary axis is being sabotaged, if you like, or sure. Mullered is my technical term. So because of that, it's a mixture of brain-body interaction. So the adrenal glands, which sit on the top of the kidneys, are involved. The hypothalamus is involved. The pituitary is involved. The nervous system is involved. So I don't think it's not a condition that is easy to label as psychological, psychiatric, or physical.
So we've recognised a systemic organ involvement rather than simply psychological, or it's hard to pinpoint exactly what the main cause is, as it were, from a physiological perspective.
Yes, and stress and burnout are intimately related, but they are also different.
Sure. And other myths in terms of what you see in your clients and in people that have reached out to you?
Yes, I think one of the perceptions is that it is something that is relatively quick to resolve. And if you're highly stressed and you take a weekend's break or you have 2 weeks holiday, the chances are you'll come back feeling a lot better and refreshed. Whereas a burnt out person, if they take a weekend or a 2 week holiday, could actually come back more affected by their burnout as a result of the holiday than less. I know that sounds very paradoxical, but they don't necessarily come back refreshed, put it that way.
That's actually very interesting. I never thought of anything like that, actually. Mm. So, and do you know why that is, or is that...
Again, it's got something to do with the cortisol and the hypothalamic pituitary axis. But I'm not a neuroscientist, so I think we better not tread too far in that direction.
That's okay. But interesting observation, just from people that you've seen, I take it, where I guess they may have been advised to take time away, and then they've come back to see you and they're no better. In fact, like you say, they might be worse.
And they're very disappointed that the holiday hasn't solved the problem. Yeah. And even psychiatrists that I've spoken to, when I've said that I've seen somebody who's had burnout for 10 years, they look incredibly shocked and say, oh, I thought it was something that came on quickly and went quickly. So I think even within the medical profession and psychiatrists as a group, they perhaps don't understand burnout. And of course, when you've got 40-50% rates of burnout amongst medical professionals, then it's hardly any wonder that they perhaps don't really understand the problem, because they're actually in it. And when you're in burnout, it's actually very difficult to see the wood for the trees.
I think it may even be even higher, the rates in and unrecognized or even unnoted. Or they're not reported, rather.
Yes, I think a lot of the research that's done on burnout looks at different parameters. So the figures that come out are sometimes quite difficult to compare. And I've seen rates from 30% up to in the 70%.
So it depends on what you're looking at and how you're defining it
in that given
paper or in that given study,
But the point is, it's too high.
Of course, yes, it is.
It's not rocket science, is it?
No, really? Absolutely. So
it would just be lovely to see it coming down, and it looks to me like it's creeping up. Another one of the myths is surrounding sleep. So people with burnout are often very tired, chronically, physically, mentally exhausted. And so people will say to them, and this is true perhaps of a lot of therapists who perhaps don't really understand the full extent of what burnout can do, is they'll say, oh, well, you know, you need to have a sleep hygiene regime and you need to get your sleep better. But the problem with somebody with burnout is that they cannot sleep better. It's no good saying sleep better or go to bed earlier or don't use your phone. These are good basic sleep hygienes for someone without burnout. Mm. But once somebody has burnout, the hypothalamus and the pituitary are intimately connected to the pineal gland where melatonin is secreted from. And melatonin is what controls your sleep cycles. So if the whole system and axis is malfunctioning, if you like,
yes,
what happens is people with burnout often don't get the deep sleep and the REM sleep that they ought to have. So they can be 8 hours in bed. They could even be 8 hours officially asleep. Their partner could say, well, I didn't see you wake up. You know, you've been asleep all night. But you wake up unrefreshed and you wake up as tired as you were when you went to bed.
So it's the quality of sleep.
It's the quality and the functionality of the sleep that is, in fact, the problem. So this is there's a lot of misinformation about burnout saying, oh, just get a good night's sleep and you know, improve your diet. Yeah. And, you know, you could give somebody the healthiest diet ever and make sure that they were in bed 8 hours a night and they'll still have burnout.
That's interesting.
They're not things not to do. I mean, you know, sleep hygiene and a good diet, you know, everybody needs to do those things.
Of course, yeah.
But as a solution for someone with burnout or heading firmly for burnout or in pre-burnout, it's not the answer.
There's far more to it.
Well, it's window dressing and sticking plasters in my view, but I'm sure a lot of people would argue against that, but that's just my view. Well, so
that's what the podcast is about.
Yes.
So absolutely. And Amandit, would you echo some of those myths?
Absolutely. And I think I can relate it, although not being a medic myself, I can relate it to my own burnout. I remember, you know, getting 1 or 2 hours of sleep a night, and thinking back now, actually, it's really resonant that probably in the 2 weeks before I sort of had to stop work, I don't remember having a dream or any sort of deep sleep. And it was, you know, it was quite sort of unsettling to go through that. And, you know, obviously relating it to my brother's story, one of the first things that he said to me was, you know, when he was having difficulties was, I can't sleep. And, you know, he tried over-the-counter sleep remedies and, you know, and God knows what, and it just wasn't helpful. I think you're absolutely right. You raise a great point. It's the quality of that deep REM sleep that's, you know, at the heart of it all.
Until you have someone tell you something like that, we don't tend to think about the minutiae of it like that. So if we maybe looked at parameters like that, like the quality of sleep more so, and all these other little things that we're learning more and more, we could potentially have more of a medical management that might eventually change the definition potentially.
Yes, I think that you've hit on something very important there, but in some ways you could argue that it's an educational issue, that we are unaware of some facts, whatever those facts are, and that merely by bringing in medical interventions, it's a little bit like shutting the gate after the horse has bolted. Too little, too late comes to mind. And I would rather see a general raising of awareness of these issues and a general education of what stress does to people, what burnout does to people, as a way of dealing with that, rather than waiting for the medical profession to pick up the pieces once the you know, the cart and horses.
Broken toy syndrome.
Yeah. 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 Prevention, in other words, rather than cure. Yes.
Absolutely.
I think one myth I've heard, and I'm really keen to seek your expert opinion, is so typically people associate burnout with very, very high workloads and hugely stressful environments. But I've heard to the contrary that some folk are susceptible to burnout, not necessarily with huge workloads. Is that true? Do you have to have a really unmanageable workload to be prone to burnout?
No, you don't. Because to give you an example, if contrary to the World Health Organization, if what I think about burnout is correct, then carers get it and they're not working. They're not working in a job. Mm. They have a job. And it's 24/7. So it's not someone telling them that they must produce more. It's not somebody saying stay longer at the office. It's just a set of circumstances that for that person has become overwhelming. So what will overwhelm one person will be very different to what overwhelms another. So there'll be some carers doing 24/7 care and they'll be fine. With a little bit of help, perhaps from family and friends, there'll be others who think they have to do it all on their own. And if they're not asking for help or not making sure that they're filling their own cup sufficiently, then they will run into burnout symptoms.
So by virtue of that, just to make sure, I guess the folks listening to this podcast have understood, it's down to, I guess, an individual's capability to manage or manage the workload or manage the factors not overwhelming them. Is that right?
No, I don't think that's quite right. Sorry if I've misled. I think that's an element of it. I think it's what causes burnout in any one individual is a cocktail of factors. And the cocktail of factors, the two main areas are the environment in which one is working and one's personality traits and social upbringings rather than environmental, right. The more personal side.
Would it be fair to say it's incredibly difficult to objectify it? So it has to be taken on a person-by-person subjective basis?
Yes, I think that's fair, but I think one can generalise a little bit and say that you know, if you look at any one person with burnout, there will be a cocktail, and the two main elements that I would always be looking for are what's happening in the workplace and what's happening in your personal life and who are you as a person? Because particularly with doctors, for example, you sometimes find that they're very keen to please patients and very keen to please their colleagues. And if you happen to have the personality trait of a people pleaser, then you are slightly more at risk of getting burnout than somebody who isn't. If you're also a perfectionist trait and a people pleaser, then you have an even higher risk of moving towards burnout. So there are personality traits. But I think what a lot of organisations and managers and bosses do is they tend to look very much at the person and what is wrong with that person. They're not resilient enough. Well, I can tell you, I have rarely met a medic in 30 years who I did not think was basically fundamentally resilient, because you don't get through the training if you're not a resilient person. So there are degrees, of course, of resilience. If you take 100 medics, there'll be one at the top who's super, super, super resilient, and there'll be one at the bottom who isn't terribly resilient. And there'll be a bell-shaped curve in between. But the majority of medics have already been through the mill. So to turn around and say to somebody in their 40s and 50s that there's a resilience problem, I think is an insult, really.
I totally agree. And, you know, just to sort of summarise that, but burnout is, as you say, it's down to individual factors, but importantly, environmental factors. And I think, critically, I think one of the key learnings from this podcast so far is that it's probably not acceptable for organisations to say, well, the problem's with the individual. It's a combination of both.
Yeah, that's a very good point. Thanks, Amandip. And in terms of the going into the NHS, as it were now, talking about the NHS side of things, obviously we've heard Amandip's story with his brother, and we are talking about doctors as well as other professions, but we do know it affects medics quite a lot. And what do you feel is the main cause of burnout within the workplace, specifically within the NHS?
Well, it's a mixture of work overload, insufficient resources, a desire to do the best for the patient all the time, all mixed together. And if you've got those personality traits that I mentioned earlier as well, you've sort of got full house.
So it's an environment where those personality traits excel and therefore more going to be more susceptible to these other environmental things. And it seems to be it's almost like a petri dish for bacteria, is the perfect breeding ground for.
Absolutely. You've hit the nail on the head completely there.
That's very interesting. Amanda, do you echo that?
There's nothing there that I disagree with at all.
Mm. Yeah. And do you think things have changed for the better since a couple of years ago, or do you think there's still a long way to go for employers to recognise burnout and deal with stress in the workplace, not just specifically to the NHS, but in other areas of work?
I think there's a long way to go, without any doubt. There's quite a lot of window dressing and sticking plasters, as I mentioned earlier on. I think one hospital introduced yoga classes for stressed doctors. I mean, I have to laugh, really. It's a complete joke. You take the average junior doctor, or even consultant for that matter, and say, do you get a lunch break? The answer is, ha ha, I had one in 19, you know, whenever it was. That was the last lunch break they got. So the chances, there may be some staff in the hospital who do manage to get to the yoga class, but I'll tell you now, it won't be the doctors.
Yeah, I think just to add to that, I think I see a bit of a difference from my perspective between the private sector and the public sector. And I'll give an example. So last week we saw 10th of October was World Mental Health Day with a focus on suicide prevention. I was fortunate enough to be invited into a very, very large global consulting firm at their corporate offices in London. And they had a whole day of awareness raising, workshops, educational seminars, and I was lucky enough to be to contribute to those and speak at one of those. I think from my perspective, the private sector realizes the value of employee mental health. It sees it equally as important as physical health, because fundamentally they understand that, you know, they have customers to, whatever services they provide, they have customers to satisfy and keep on board and you know, stay with them as a business. And the employees, I'd say that very loosely, but every single employee is a key critical part of that. I think for me, the NHS is a little bit behind the curve on that. I think it's getting better. It's starting to, you know, have the right conversations like the ones that we're having today. But there's very, very much a long way to go. And I think one thing that I would be keen to see is a lot of learnings from what the private sector is doing could easily be transposable to the public sector in giving folk the importance, or recognising the importance of health, of doctors specifically, let's keep it specific to this podcast, in relation to keeping patients safe and happy, because I think there's a very clear correlation between the two.
Yes, I would agree with all of that. I would also say that if you've got a junior doctor who's been asked to carry someone else's bleep because they're away on holiday, and another person's bleep because the other person in the unit hasn't been recruited, you've then got a recipe for a complete disaster, because most junior doctors are busy anyway to the limit of their abilities. You then create multiple interruptions into the day by other people's bleeps going off. So at the bottom of it all is policy decisions and how people are being expected to work. You can give as many training days and, you know, awareness days of mental health until you're blue in the face. But if you do things like that to individuals, it's quite heinous. I mean, I would go as far as to say that in 10 or 20 years' time, I would like to think that we would regard the existence of burnout very much like we would, or that we do regard sending little boys up chimneys and children down coal mines, because it's completely heinous.
Mm. I must say, just from personal experiences, just to add to that, as we've got the sort of environment within the hospital workplace being the high workload, having to carry someone's bleep, and just to add almost fuel to the fire, as it were, I think there's other factors as well. And these are outside of the hospital, but still within the medical profession. And that could be something simple, like the having to move around a lot, having to wait for months and months and months to get a contract. And as I said in a previous podcast, I left the job once and then got my contract for that job after I had left.
Dear,
and so
dear.
Even things like trying to get a mortgage or trying to get a loan.
It affects your whole life.
Yeah, so all these little things that we don't see so much within on the shop floor, as it were, in that environment. They're still associated with medicine, and it's still something that I think needs to improve. Even things like you know, paying for parking or not finding parking actually is probably the biggest issue I've had in recent years, and not having a locker to put your stuff in. These are all little things, but they can have a big difference to your quality of life in your workplace. And I think these are all little stresses that mount up.
Yes, I think what you're describing there is something that I managed to encapsulate in a diagram. I drew a picture of an iceberg, and the bit above is the burnout you see, and the 90% below is the burnout you don't see.
I think that sums it up, actually. Yeah. Absolutely. Yeah. Yeah. And do you think that's a relatively fair thing to say? I don't know, from obviously your brother was a very senior doctor, so those things may have been obviously in place in his life, contracts and parking and all sorts, but from other side of things, do you think there's definitely other factors involved?
I think the honest answer is that I'll probably never fully know, because as you say, you know, things like burnout, and you know, it's a 10% visible, 90% not visible. Having said that, I think that's even more pronounced in doctors. If it was me and I had to put a measure on it, I'd probably say 1% visible and 99% invisible. But very, very sadly, when that 1% does become visible, it's, as we've seen from my brother's case, it's, you know, it's far too late. I can only speak from the experiences that I'm, you know, sort of privy to, particularly relating to my brother and some of the other cases that I've come across in my journey. But I think something I realize is, try not to go off topic too much, is even the simplest thing outside of work can really tip you over the edge. And I'll give a very good example. So with my charity work, Doctors in Distress, I got an email from the website hosting company saying that there was a dubious amount of bit of code there. And, you know, recently it just flipped me over the edge on that weekend. I was very, very on edge. And I relate that to something actually that happened to my brother, in that I think there was some weird story that his gardener didn't come to do his tree hedging or something like that. And he got, you know, I remember the few weeks before, he got really, really agitated. And he was very much, as you say, you know, it's only typical doctor, perfectionist, you know, very much a people pleaser as well. So it's often the little things that can sort of tip you over the edge that can become visible or can become invisible. But I'm sure we'll touch on the, you know, the signs to spot in others, you know, in a short while.
Yes. Thank you, Amanda. And on that, actually, we was going to move on to the signs and things. I wanted to ask you, Sonia, from your experience and also just expertise. We did mention it before on the previous podcast, but would like to hear it from your perspective in terms of the signs and symptoms that we should be looking out for people and ourselves as well, if we think we have burnout.
Yes, I think there are several ways of looking at spotting signs. On the one hand, it's actually very easy to spot them if you know what they are. On the other hand, people often hide them and conceal them. So if you're covering them up, and burnout typically comes on very, very slowly, you've got a transition from extreme stress, it slowly morphing into a more serious condition, which is burnout. But it doesn't happen overnight. It can happen over many years. So that makes it incredibly difficult for people living and working with burnout sufferers. It makes it much easier for someone like me, because I know exactly what the symptoms are and I can, you know, spot it at 50 paces sort of thing. But that's because I've been working in it for 30 years. And I think at the coalface, it is actually much, much harder to spot these things. And in fact, I'm even writing an e-course at the moment, the 15 reasons why people don't face up to burnout. And some of those reasons are cover-up reasons, denial, resistance. And again, Amandeep, you've inferred this and intimated this already, is that, you know, there's 1% of the burnout showing in medics. And part of that is that they're really, really good at hiding it.
Mm. So here's a, I guess, a very direct question. If you're burnt, if you reach the point that you're completely burnt out, is that a sign that you cannot cope with your work?
Even that is debatable. It's such a good question because it's hard to answer that.
The reason I ask is because when my brother was looking back, when he was burnt out and he was signed off by his occupational health, he saw that as an inability to cope and to do his job properly.
That's different, isn't it? That's actually a different statement. So what the person perceives as themselves being able to cope and what the actual fact is of them being able to cope are sometimes two different things.
Right.
So a lot of doctors would take it as an insult or a put down that somebody was saying that they weren't coping. Mm-hmm. But the reality is they're not coping. But if you're in denial about it and then you then feel that that's an affront to your dignity and affront to your professionalism, then you're going to resist it and take it very personally. But the inability to cope or the problem with coping with things actually happened some time before that.
Right.
But it just wasn't noticed by anyone. It wasn't noticed by the sufferer and it wasn't noticed by the people around them. Except that if you now go back and ask people, I'm sure a lot of them would say, well, actually, we did notice X, Y, and Z, but they were either too frightened to speak up. Mm. If you point the finger at any doctor, there's always the risk of a General Medical Council, GMC, investigation. If it's thought of to be a mental health problem, and we've already said burnout is not a mental health problem, it's not even a medical problem. However, it is a problem, but you will get lumped in with the psychiatric conditions and the addictions side of the GMC, and they can come down fairly heavily. So the key really is to be spotting problems with people's workload way, 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 way before it gets to anything you would even remotely call burnout. But that's the challenge, is that a lot of doctors are working under constant, unrelenting stress.
Yeah.
And therefore, a lot of them are now heading into burnout.
And I think that's often seen as the norm, which yes. is a bit of a challenge, is that, well, that's just the way it is. So on that front, you mentioned there that it's, you know, you've got to spot the signs early. What would you see as those signs? And I guess who would you see as spotting those signs?
Gosh, two very big questions. Ideally, one would be spotting signs of stress and organisational malfunction and dysfunction at early stages. But we know that doesn't happen. So there's also the issue of spotting stress signs early and the issue of spotting burnout signs early. Ideally, one would be spotting stress signs early first, because that's prevention. If you're waiting until you're spotting the burnout signs, I would already say something has gone wrong.
What stress signs would you be specifically looking out for? What the key, or what the most prominent stress signs?
What stresses one person will be another person's challenges. So it's actually quite difficult. You need to ask individuals, what is stressing you at the moment?
Mm.
And they will generally tell you if you ask them.
In terms of physical manifestations, things that we could see from a, you know, from a relative or a close friend or even a colleague, things that we might notice with them walking down the corridor or just speaking to them at lunchtime, for example, are there any little clues that we might pick up on?
I think doctors are so well compensated for dealing with stress that they cover it up so much until it's gone to burnout. So I think sometimes the symptoms and signs just wouldn't be spottable by anyone.
Sure. And
certainly not in passing them. You know, I could walk down a hospital corridor, I wouldn't be able to spot burnout. And I'm a burnout expert. It isn't until I sat down with a person and started to talk to them that I would be able to even begin to unravel the feelings, because initially they'll be covering them up.
So essentially it's almost, especially in a medical field, as it were, in the hospital context, it's almost essential that it's brought forward maybe by the person themselves, rather than obviously leaving it too late.
I think it's a tall order to expect the individual to bring it out themselves when they're working in a culture that is not burnout friendly or stress friendly in terms of outing yourself.
Sure.
I think it's got to be a combination of people being able to feel more assertive and being able to voice things. But then you have to be working in a culture where you don't feel threatened doing that. Mm. And if voicing concerns about your performance or your coping is going to lead to a GMC investigation, when in fact what you need to be told is you're working too hard, you know, you need to leave work at 5 o'clock, or we'll take you off the on-call rota for 3 or 4 months and let's see how you do on that. That would be a start towards dealing with stress and indeed to an extent burnout as well. But I just think it's really hard for individuals to voice their stress unless there is an environment where it is safe to do that. And I would say it isn't.
It's obviously there's a stigma you feel attached to admitting that you're having these issues, having this burnout or having this stress. And obviously mentioned that it's very difficult to spot burnout, especially in people that are very, very prone to hiding it, like medics. So, and it's difficult to expect people to obviously come forward with this for these reasons. So is the solution, and correct me if I'm wrong, is the solution to create that environment and to educate the employers themselves to allowing for a safe environment for this to take place, and maybe even from the GMC side of things, say this is not something that's going to affect your future record, your future ability to progress up the career ladder or in any way taint your medical career?
Well, I wouldn't like to speak for the GMC because they have their own agendas. So, but I do think it is a combination of educating everyone, not just the bosses and the managers, but the people at the bottom of the tree as well. So that would be from medical students, junior doctors, F1, F2 upwards. So that's an education aspect. The other aspect is a culture change, which is, of course, you know, with the biggest employer in Europe, it's just not possible to change the culture overnight anyway. But it doesn't mean one shouldn't try. And Amandeep is doing quite a lot to influence that, I think. But there are some things, if we focus just on burnout rather than just stress. Freudenberger was an expert in burnout in the 1970s. And he came up with a 12-stage process or phases which people go through when burnout begins. And at the early stages, stage 1, 2, and 3, there are things like the compulsion to achieve at the expense of one's own health, lack of self-care, seeing working harder as a solution to solving problems in the workplace rather than solving the problem in the workplace. You just work harder. And dismissing overwork as something that's just part of the job, losing hobbies. Those are all early signs of burnout. But again, if you take all of those, none of those should be happening if stress is being flagged up more effectively. And then the later stages of burnout would be things like depression and, you know, total collapse, taking sick leave, not being able to carry on. So there are 12 stages altogether. And if people were more aware of what those 12 stages were, then that would perhaps help flag burnout as an issue.
And Amanda, obviously, your brother, you're very, very close, and you knew him on a level that no one else did. Did you notice anything specifically that you thought, this is something that I can relate to other people that I see with burnout?
So I guess to answer that as shortly and concisely as I can, the approach that I at the time took was to triangulate his behavior to mine. If I were to triangulate that then to what I know now, things would be very, very different. So when I looked at him at the time, I probably had about 10% of the knowledge that we've just shared today. I had absolutely no idea. All I could relate to was my own experience. And I guess my experience was quite slightly tainted in that, again, not being a medic, you know, I took 2 months off work because I worked in an industry, or I'm a pharmacist by training, but the job that I was in was not patient facing. So I didn't have that pressure of having patients dying in front of me. My brother was a cardiologist. He dealt with very, very sick people. I think that was a large part of that pressure that he faced, and I didn't have that. So I probably didn't recognize that pressure that's on doctors as much as it was particularly on my brother and all doctors who are in similar situations. I think for me, I mean, just to sort of go back a step around the culture change piece, for me, it's around educating the individual, and I think that has to start way back in medical school. And the message is very, very clear and simple. And I'll try not to use any expletives, but I'll give it a go. Now, as you say, the NHS is going to take years and decades to evolve. It's a great organisation and it needs to continue. It's a great part of this country. The message to medical students is sadly has to be, on the first day that you're an F1, the first day that you qualify, it's going to be awful. You're going to be working in a very poor environment, generally. There are some pockets of good behaviours and good cultures, etc. But generally, it's a bit of a crap system. You're going to have to deal with it. Things will not change as quickly as they need to. So you need to recognise the signs in yourself, and you need to recognise the signs in those around you. It's very much a we're in this together attitude that I think that needs to be embedded. And I think that can be done very, very quickly. One of my aims and one of the work I'm trying to do with Doctors in Distress is to try and put in the syllabus of every single medical school the need for self-care as a medical student, starting in year one all the way to year five, but equally important, preparing them for that first day in August when they all go onto the wards and making sure that they have the skills necessary to recognise when they are burnt out and when they are stressed. I think for me, the higher up culture change, that's going to take a lot of a different approach, and that's going to take years. But that small step, in my hope, will at least help save some more lives.
Thank you. Yes, Sonia, would you like to add to that?
I wholeheartedly support everything Amandeep has just said. I would like to see more senior people in medicine trained in being able to bring out stressors and deal with them more proactively. So if you keep ignoring stress in your team, and this works up the ladder as well as down the ladder, if everyone is ignoring everybody else's stress and it's never ever being voiced or discussed, it's a breeding ground. So what I'd like to see is seniors having meetings with their juniors, not about patients, not about exams, not about the hoop jumping that one needs to do to qualify and progress in one's career, not about patient beds, but sitting down saying, right, what stresses have we all had this week? And let's talk about them. But that implies in itself that there's going to be half an hour in the working week to be able to do that. So rather than putting on yoga classes and, you know, salads in the salad bar, I'd rather see seniors given half an hour each week to sit down with their teams.
And I agree with that. And just to add to what you added to what I said originally, we're going to play ping pong a little bit. So something that I learned with my brother's case since we did the last podcast was, so as I understand it, again, apologies if this terminology is wrong, but all doctors should have a job plan, is my understanding. Now, I saw my brother's job plan, or his latest version, but what really surprised me was the number of hours that were stated in there and the activities completely was not related to what he was doing, which is one part of the surprise. But the biggest shock of all was there was no process, or there's no apparent consistent process within the health system to even monitor or manage what doctors are doing in relation to their job plans. And I think for me, that's something that's a very, very simple output or change that can happen that would give people the time they need to speak, would enable basic things such as monitoring workloads that are, as we've touched upon earlier, are one of the factors relating to burnout. And I think things like that are really, really simple should be put in place quite quickly that can help solve a lot of these issues that we're talking about. So here's a question, and I'll relate it to obviously the case that's closest to me. So when my brother obviously got to the point where he was completely burnt out, completely exhausted, he was referred to his occupational health, who basically said, right, the GP's seeing you, you're signed off for a month. Knowing him and knowing his traits, and I think knowing that everything that I've learned on this journey so far, and I know there's much more to learn, he saw that very much as a sign of failure as a doctor. That's the first time in his life that he perceived that he ever failed. And it's been suggested to me that an alternative, better way to cope with reaching that point of burnout is not necessarily to take time off straight away, but to probably continue working, but have a very, very structured plan and a very, very open plan with the powers that be to say, right, we need to gradually decrease the work so as not to lose any self-motivation or self-respect, whatever emotions or behaviors that you want to put on it. And then such is the point where that individual is also in that process being kept safe, being monitored indirectly by colleagues, reaches a point where they're comfortable to say, okay, that immediate stressor has gone down. I can now step back with comfort without being seen as a sign of failure and then take the time I need to recharge. So I guess my question is, well, the statement I'm going to make is, I think had that happened, my brother would probably still be alive. Do you think that model of managing the end stage of burnout to recharge, that gap of stopping work to recharge, is that a good model, or do you see other ways of doctors doing it? Because I'm very, very conscious, as you say, doctors will just say, I'm fine, there's nothing wrong. Okay, take some time off. Oh, okay, I'm a failure.
What you've just said, Amandeep, is both incredibly sad but also incredibly beautifully phrased. I would never manage somebody with burnout automatically suggesting that they go off sick. That may, for some people, be the right thing, but I certainly think it is fundamentally the wrong thing for some people.
And how do you know the difference between whether it's right or wrong for some or not?
I think you look at the profession that they're in. So you've just described the medical profession. I think there are perhaps some professions where going off sick, you know, perhaps wouldn't have that effect of feeling failure. I think if you take 100 doctors, the majority of them probably would feel that that was some form of failure, but there might be a few that didn't. There might be a few absolutely desperate for some time off. I think the problem with having people off sick with burnout is that the burnout doesn't go away when they go home that afternoon. The burnout remains, and the burnout will remain for some months. Even if it is properly managed and cared for, it will be there for some time. So what you've just described is sending somebody home to sit, you know, in effect in a dark room, not having enough energy to do anything. So they won't start playing golf and, you know, go out and see their friends or anything. They'll be sitting in a dark room at home. And add to that the feeling of failure on top of somebody who is perhaps already severely burnt out, already with some signs and symptoms of depression. It is a risky thing to do to sign someone off sick. And because, as you rightly just said, you then get no support. You're on your own.
So is what I've suggested probably the right thing to consider for most doctors in that same scenario?
I would like to think that every occupational health department would be knowledgeable enough to know that in certain circumstances and certain professions, signing somebody off sick is a flawed or dangerous or risky activity unless you give them a huge amount of support. So keeping them at work, reducing that would be probably more acceptable for most people. But of course, when somebody gets to the severe stages of burnout, their decision making and their capabilities are affected. And you've got patient care to look for as
It's a double-edged sword, I mean.
It is a completely double-edged sword. But I certainly wouldn't want to see a severely burnt out person automatically signed off for a period of a month or, you know, long periods. I would much rather they were put on light duties or non-clinical duties of some sort would be better than sending them to be on their own.
Thank you. Thank you both. That was actually very enlightening to listen to, actually, the final stages of that, especially just an observational point of view and in the hospital that, you know, we've worked in and over my experiences. I can honestly say sometimes in time of stress, actually being at work has helped without a detriment to clinical practice, as it were. But it's nice to be in the environment where I'm surrounded by colleagues, I'm surrounded by friends, I'm chatting to patients and occupying my mind, but in a constructive way. And every now and then, just being around these people who are caring individuals in general, you know, that by nature of working in the hospital has been helpful in those periods.
And you're still adding, you feel as though you're still adding value.
Yeah. Yeah. And yeah. We've taken very few sick days in our lives, I'm sure. But you do notice, even when you're desperately unwell with an awful cold and you're sitting at home and on that odd day watching something on TV, you feel useless. Actually, in that day, yep. Even just something as simple as, I know I can't be at work because it's not safe, but you feel useless and you almost can't wait to get back into work. And that's why you see so many people struggle through with a cold, coughing and spluttering and saying, go home. I have been sent home before, you know, because I looked unwell. And you do, when you get home, you feel like a little part of you's actually been taken away. And, you know, I think that's very important what you've said.
I think the message to take home really about burnout is that if you're an occupational health doctor or a GP signing people off sick, is to just be wary of the issue of signing someone off sick. That it is, we've already said that the World Health Organization doesn't consider burnout a medical illness. Whether they're right or not is another issue, but if that's the case, the person is not ill with burnout. They merely need managing. They need their burnout managed correctly. And I don't think, especially now having heard Amandeep's story about his brother, I don't think that signing people off sick is an automatic thing that should occur.
Thank you.
It might occur in some, but
sure,
it shouldn't be an automatic assumption that that's what happens.
Thank you. Thank you both.
Thank you.
I'd very much like to thank Amandeep and Dr. Sonia Hutton-Taylor once again for appearing on the podcast. As I said earlier, it was an incredibly enlightening experience listening to these two prominent members of the field and approaching burnout from a perspective that I wouldn't think to approach it from. And even after the first couple of podcasts we've done on this topic, it still goes to show just how much more we have to learn about it and how much more we can do to help prevent it and help treat those who are suffering from it. On that note, to help us further understand the problem and help come up with solutions, Amandeep does have a website called doctorsindistress.org.uk, and I will put a link to that in the description of this podcast. And on that website, in the research section, there is a survey link. And what the survey link is about is trying to further gain the opinions related to the concepts of medical colleagues caring for each other. And this is a key part in trying to help understand some of the problems that we're facing with burnout and how we can help to deal with them. So if you are a medic, please do take the time to fill out that survey, and I will put a link to that survey directly into the description of the podcast above or below. Also, I will include links to Dr. Sonia Hutton-Taylor's website, which is burnoutgeese.com. And that is a fantastic resource where you can download a free burnout starter kit, which gives you a fact sheet, a learning questionnaire, and also an invitation to her next webinar. I'll also include some other links, as I have done in previous episodes, for anyone suffering with stress and burnout that might find them useful to help gain some further support.
As always, thank you for taking the time to listen to this podcast. And if you enjoyed it, please do leave a review on iTunes. I very much appreciate it. And if you do have any questions or any topics that you'd like me to discuss in future episodes, please do email me at doctorsview@gmail.com or visit my website where you can contact me there at doctorsview.co.uk. And as always, please look after yourselves, and I look forward to joining you again next time. I'm Dr. Bolivios. Goodbye.